with your earlier website, We Feel Fine, you and Sepp Kamvar made this gorgeous tool for collecting and sharing online feelings. How is Cowper different?
Well, We Feel Fine is really more of a portrait. It's something that you look at and maybe discover things about the world from looking at it. Cowper is really more of a tool. It's something that anybody can use every day to tell their own stories directly. You can also use it as a portrait, as in the same way you can use We Feel Fine that way. But at its heart, Cowper is really a tool for people to use. Mm.
So what is Cowper?
So it's a few things. I think the way I could most succinctly describe it is that it's a very simple tool that anyone can use to tell very beautiful stories on the web. And as you tell your stories and as you keep a diary of your life, it allows you to collaborate with other people in telling the stories of the larger sagas that are happening in the world. So sagas is this concept that's really core to Cowper, and it's this idea that there are these news events now, things like the Japanese earthquake and the Indian tsunami and the Arab Spring and the war in Iraq, and more recently here at home, the Occupy Wall Street movement. These things that happen in a very decentralized, complex, quickly changing, unpredictable dynamic, and they touch many, many people's lives. And the mainstream news media has really been struggling, I think, with how to cover these types of stories because they're so loose and amorphous. And so Cowper presents a new way to try to cover those types of stories, these stories that touch millions of people's lives. And so Cowper allows anybody to collaborate in chronicling those types of sagas using very simple human stories, the things that you or I might stumble into in an afternoon, like, you know, I've been spending a lot of time up at Occupy Oakland here in the Bay Area. And the things that have been most touching to me have not been the angry protests or the ideology or the demonstrations or the actions, but have been the small, quiet human moments that happen within all that stuff. So for instance, one night I was standing in the streets of Oakland at about 1 a.m. It was the night that the general strike had happened, and these anarchist kids had broken into a building, and about 300 police in full riot gear had formed lines out on Broadway and were yelling at everybody to disperse. And they had given warnings about shooting tear gas, and they were about to fire these tear gas canisters into the crowd, and there was about 45 seconds left before they were going to do that. And everybody was just madly running around, putting on gas masks if they had them, wrapping up their faces in bandanas if they didn't. And there was this general feeling of hysteria. And I noticed this young couple in their early 20s that were just standing in the middle of all of this chaos, and they were just kissing each other. They were just holding each other and making out in the middle of it all. And I saw this and I took a picture of it, and I thought, you know, that's what it's all about in a way. I mean, it's like we have this crazy stuff that rages all around us in the world, but it's really the way that we hold on to our humanity in the midst of all that, that's what it's all about, I think. And I think if there's a message in Cowper, that is the message, that this crazy stuff is raging all around us in the world, yet we still find a way to be who we are as individuals. We still find a way to be a good mom, to be a good dad, to be a good friend, and to do the human stuff that makes life rich and worth living. So it's really like humanizing the news.
That image sounds more like a little piece of poetry than like a story, actually. So if you were going to turn that into a story or post on Cowper, what would you do? Mm-hmm. What would it look like?
So that is actually a story that I have up there right now. And what it consists of is the photograph that I took of this couple with the people running around them and them kissing in the middle of the craziness. And then I just wrote up a little vignette about what it felt like at that moment, the things I heard around me, what it smelled like, what it looked like. And it's just this very simple pairing of a short written vignette with text, with a photograph. And then there's lots of kind of metadata about that moment in my life, like where it took place, when it took place, who was there, what it was about. And all of that metadata becomes connection points to the rest of the ecosystem. So you can see that story in context and see other things that relate to it. So that's really the
You said one of the points of Cowper is to allow people to post stories like this, but then connect mm-hmm. to these larger narratives. You called them sagas. Can you explain more what the saga is?
Sure. So in at the moment on Cowbird, there's only one saga that we're starting with, which is the Occupy Wall Street saga. We call it Occupy. And we've opened up an invitation to anybody on the internet to come on and contribute their personal firsthand accounts of experiences they've had relating to that saga in some way or another. Now, over time, we'll be adding many more sagas to Cowbird. And sagas are not only things like news events, but they can also be things like the first person you fell in love with, or aging, or these other kind of more timeless experiences that we all go through.
And how would, you were talking about sagas, how would mm-hmm. that post that you made of that moment of the couple kissing with chaos swirling around them, how would that connect into the larger saga of the Occupy story?
Sure. So the way Cowbird works is that it allows anybody to keep a diary of their life, and that diary consists of individual stories. So that story of the couple kissing right before the tear gas is part of my personal diary. But I've also flagged that story as being relevant to the Occupy saga. So in that case, it shows up in two places. It shows up both in my diary and also as part of the broader Occupy saga, to which many, many different people are contributing to.
So what would I see then if I went on to Cowbird and I wanted to see the saga of the Occupy movement?
So if you went on to Cowbird and you were interested in seeing the human side of the Occupy movement, you would click on the Occupy tab, and it would open up a very large photo mosaic grid of images that were taken by different photographers from all over the world whose lives have been touched by the Occupy saga in one way or another. And you can click on any of those images to slide to that particular story and experience that story. And then there are numerous other ways that you can slice and dice the saga of Occupy. So you can see a map of the saga and see where it's taken place in the world. You can see a timeline and see how it's changed over time. You can see the characters involved, the main people that lots of individuals have been mentioning with respect to the story, to the saga. You can also see the top tags that are being used. So there are all of these different ways to slice and dice that saga. And but the main view you see is this interactive photo mosaic grid of images, and that's reverse chronological. So the idea is that over time, you'll be able to scan through that grid and see how the thing looked. You'll be able to see the first winter snowfalls coming in, and things will go white when snow arrives, and you'll be able to see all the blue tarps during the phase of the movement that was very much about tents. Now that that phase is over, there'll be a new phase. So it gives you this very kind of non-reductionist self-portrait of these major global news events.
You know, it's fascinating. It sounds like you're inventing an entirely new form of electronic storytelling, or a new way of dealing with huge amounts of information, a huge volume of stories. You're figuring out a different way to represent them all.
Yeah, and specifically, I'm interested in finding a deeper way to represent these things, because one thing that we all feel now is this feeling that we're just drowning in data all of the time. And a lot of my earlier work dealt with these very large data sets that people were spitting out onto the internet, sentence fragments, photographs, things like this. And one thing I've been noticing is that throughout history, communication has been getting shorter and shorter and more fractured. So you start with things like letter writing, which is very deep and slow, and then you move into phone calls, and then you move into faxes, and then you move into emails, then text messages. Now we're kind of hovering around tweets as the canonical form of communication right now. But it's unclear to me that there's another level of compression after the tweet, unless we start going around and making monosyllabic grunts at each other or something like this. So I think you know, we're at this interesting point where, in a way, we've reached the terminal velocity of how fast our communication can go. And then a question arises, which is, well, do we stay there? Do we keep tweeting? Or do we somehow find an even faster way? Or do we hit some kind of wall and bounce back in the other direction, suddenly starting to crave a little bit more depth and substance again? And I'm betting on that. I think that people are already feeling this. And Cowbird is really putting a flag in the sand and saying, this is a space on the internet which is dedicated to deeper, longer-lasting, more nourishing storytelling than you're going to find anywhere else on the web. And that's really what we're trying to do with Cowbird.
Are you suggesting that we're kind of approaching a critical mass of data, of information, and the next step isn't to learn to read faster, but it's to learn to sort of jump up to almost a meta level and begin to see patterns of information, to begin to build larger stories out of all those little individual tweets rather than regarding each of them as a full story in and of themselves.
I think it's both that. It's both trying to see the patterns in the data, but it's also finding a way to go a little bit deeper. You know, I always have this image of if you took a stone and if you took a string and if you wrapped the string around the stone and then you went to a lake and you pulled the string and the stone along the lake, and the faster that you pull the string, the closer to the surface the stone will stay. And if you pull it fast enough, it'll actually start skipping along the surface. But if you start to slow down and you move the string a little bit more slowly, then the rock starts to sink into the lake and you get to a deeper level. And that's very much the way I think about what we should be doing now in terms of storytelling, is just slowing down a little bit so we can try to reach some greater depths than we have been reaching in the last few years with all of the crazy, frantic nowness that has been so endemic on the web recently.
Hmm. I'm curious, why the name Cowbird?
It's a funny name, and basically the reason for that is to try to combine the traits of a cow and a bird together. So when I think about a cow, you know, I think of something very slow and steady and methodical, like sitting out there in the fields chewing on some grass. And when I think of a bird, I think of something very fast and free and loose and joyful. And I think the internet recently, things like Twitter and Facebook, have been all bird and no cow. And then you have more traditional mediums like novels and operas, which are like all cow and no bird. And so this project is really trying to combine those two extremes to create an experience that's both contemplative and deep and nourishing, but that's also very fast and efficient and joyful and fun to use, because those are things we've come to expect from our technology now. And those things have to be in place, otherwise people won't use something.
It sounds like you've given us another metaphor for a human being. We're all part cow and part bird, aren't we?
I think so. And I think, you know, technology is always a reflection of who we are as people. There's this idea from Marshall McLuhan that technology basically extends the capabilities we already have. So like a hammer is an extension of the hand. A piano is an extension of the voice, really. And so good technologies reflect who we already are, and they make us more that way. So I think the technologies we've seen in the last few years have been very good at feeding the kind of frantic, compulsive side of us. But I think there's this other side of us that's been starving, and that other side has more to do with plumbing the depths and really connecting with people on a deeper level, and really studying your own experience also in a deeper, longer-lasting way. So it's that aspect of us as people that I think technology hasn't been doing a great job with so far, that I'm really trying to see if we can feed with the Cowbird Project.
When you were talking about the way about gathering all of these individual stories that are part of sagas, it kind of sounds like crowdsourced news, and yet these stories, some may be news stories, true stories, but some might not be. Does it matter if they're true?
It doesn't really matter. It's more the feeling. There's this idea that you know, you see this sometimes in like the novels of Tolstoy or the movies of Werner Herzog or Chinese epic poetry, where basically you have this situation where there's many, many, many individual elements, and no one of these elements really tells you the whole story. And when you start to get enough of these things coming together, this kind of feeling starts to emerge. This sense comes through it all. And I think that feeling that comes through is actually closer to the truth of the thing than any one account of it could ever be. So with Cowbird, it's really this idea that once you have enough real things that happened in the course of one of these sagas, you start to get a sense of what the emotional core of that saga is. And it's not necessarily the factual truth, it's more the idea of the poetic truth. And I think that's actually that actually ends up resonating with us more deeply in the end.
You know what I love about this is, like you, I so often have the feeling that it's just there's too much information out there, you know, between the emails and the tweets and the Facebook posts and the blogs. There are days when I feel like my brain is going to burst. And what you're doing, it strikes me, is you're finding beauty in information overload. I didn't think it was possible.
Yeah, you know, I like to show people try to show people the beautiful side of stuff that's not often seen as beautiful. Like, you know, the project I spoke with you about last time, We Feel Fine, was really about taking this web, which at the time was considered a very cold, geeky, inhuman place, and showing people that it actually had a lot of soul and humanity to it. And now everybody knows that the web is the social web. It's a very human place. And I think in the same way now with Cowbird, I'm trying to take a space that people tend to think of as being very superficial and frantic and crazy, and showing that there can actually be a contemplative quality to it as well, and that you can actually create stuff that will still resonate in 50 years from now, and it won't get washed away with the torrent of new messages in the next 1 hour. It's going to actually last. And that's something that's a feeling I haven't felt for many years. I used to keep these very elaborate sketchbooks when I was a little bit younger, that I would make by hand, and I would fill them up with watercolor paintings and ticket stubs and dead insects and dead plants, and I would add about a new page every day. And it was this wonderful feeling of slowly creating this artifact of my lived experience. And I stopped keeping these books very abruptly. I got robbed at gunpoint in 2003, and one of the things that was stolen was a book with about eight months of work in it. And at that point, I turned to computers. And ever since turning to computers, I've never had that feeling that I was building something in the way I used to feel I was building those sketchbooks. And with Cowbird, I'm finally having that feeling again, that I can spend time telling these stories. And as I do so, my overall life story becomes more and more beautiful. And I'm also contributing to the larger collective stories that we're all taking part in, and that those collective stories also become more beautiful as I do my little part to tell my stories.
Hmm. There's a line at the bottom of the screen on Cowbird, goes, "To be a witness to life." What does that mean to you?
For me, that's really the purpose of this project is, you know, there's this idea that as we live our lives, we see stuff and we notice things, and most of the time we're too busy to write those things down or to tell anybody else about it. But there are things we all see on a day-to-day basis. We can be walking down the street or waiting in line at a store, and we notice stuff. And I think that unless you tell people those things that you notice, those things will be forgotten. They won't be noticed by anybody else. And I think there's almost a responsibility we have as individuals to tell other people about the things that we notice, that we feel have some kind of resonance. So there's this idea that we can become like students of each other's experience. And in the same way that we're learning from our own experience, we can also use the things that we've learned to teach other people, so that they can stand on our shoulders, and collectively we can grow more. So it's this idea of creating like a experiential library. And this has been a dream of mine for many years, to create a kind of public library for human experience. You know, we have libraries for every other kind of thing. We have libraries for science and literature and math and historical fact, but we actually don't have one for the stuff that ordinary people go through in everyday life. I mean, I'm thinking of a library that teaches me how to deal with an aging parent who's approaching death, or how to deal with being a woman who just got diagnosed with breast cancer and how to deal with that, or how to learn about somebody on a first date. You know, these types of classic experiences that we all go through as individuals, there's no real way to see how other people have taken those things. And I'm not thinking of some cheesy kind of self-help way, but just like the honest testimonies of, this is what happened to me, this is what I went through, and this is how I dealt with it. This may be useful to you. That kind of tone. And if there were such a library for human experience, these things could outlive us. The lessons that we learn as individuals, the wisdom that we gain as individuals, could outlive us and could become part of the commons, so that other people can look to them for guidance, people living now and also people in future generations. So this has been a dream of mine for many years, to build basically a public library for human experience. And Cowbird is an attempt at starting to do that.
You know, that's a kind of mythic sort of archetypal dream of yours to kind of create. It's almost like creating a virtual representation of the entire human race and the sum total of all of its knowledge. And I know I'm making that sound far more grandiose than you actually intend, but doesn't it strike you also that there's maybe something a little inhuman about that? When humans, we're meant to die. We're meant to die, yeah. And maybe what we know is meant to die with us to make room for the next generation. You know, the something about computers, they're inorganic pieces of information, and they don't ever die. They're in there forever and ever as bits and ones and zeros. But that isn't human.
I think I know what you're saying, and I think that you know, the person who most traffics in this space is this guy Ray Kurzweil, who I'm sure you know, who believes in the singularity, when computers are basically going to become self-aware and basically supersede humans as the dominant species on Earth. I tend to take a more moderate view of that. I'm not sure if that's necessarily around the corner. But he really believes in this idea of capturing everything so that you can basically teach the artificial intelligence to become you once your physical body dies. I don't like that view. I mean, I tend to agree with you that we are organic beings. We do have a fixed time here on Earth, and it's important that we die. I think death is actually the thing that gives life meaning. If there were no death, life would be incredibly banal. So I think it's very important that things have an end. But I also believe in the idea of learning, and I also believe in the idea that we can grow as individuals and that we can grow as a species from generation to generation by learning the things that others have already learned before us. I think there's a kind of stupid tragedy to the number of experiences that are learned the hard way and then learned the hard way again by other people in the next generation and again and again and again throughout history. And this is one of the kind of stupid tragedies of human history, is the way we keep making the same mistakes over and over again on a personal level and also on a cultural level. And so I think if there were some way to mitigate that phenomenon a little bit so that we could learn from each other's experiences a little bit more, so that we don't have to repeat all the same mistakes again and again, and that even as we die as individuals, the overall species becomes better, becomes wiser over time.
Yeah, I keep thinking this sounds like a kind of scrapbook of humanity. And I've also been wondering a little bit lately, what happens with digital personas as people die? You know, these virtual selves continue as static zeros and ones while the person and their memories are gone, which made me wonder how Cowbird will deal with that. And, I mean, what would you want your digital legacy to be?
It's a really interesting question. Cowbird doesn't deal with this directly yet, although it's something I would like to find an elegant way of handling. I mean, one thing I could imagine is that in the same way you have a will in the physical world where you can give your house and your dog and your money to the people that you love after you're no longer around, maybe there should be some way of appointing digital custodians to take care of your digital self after you're no longer around. And they may decide just to leave it there as is, as a relic to who you were, as a monument or a tribute to who you were as a person, or they may decide to delete it. Maybe this is the equivalent of like being somebody who gets buried or being somebody who gets cremated. Maybe you want some kind of site that your loved ones can go and visit, or maybe you don't want that. Maybe you want to be scattered into the ocean. And maybe there'll be a similar trade-off that we'll have to think about doing for our digital personas. Do we want to leave behind a mark, or do we want to be scattered into the wind?
So the Cowbird project is still very new. How do you imagine it will grow over time? I mean, if you could come back in 20 years and look at it, what do you think it would look like?
Well, it is very new. It's not even launched yet. I'm planning to release it in a couple of days. But my dream for the project is really to build this library of human experience that is available in every major language, that is used by people all over the world, that is totally open, where everything becomes part of the commons and part of the public record, and becomes a research resource for humans all over the planet to go to learn about how other people have dealt with things. So really a library for life.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Let me see if Sarah has anything else she wants me to ask. Sure. You know, you said people can have this choice, be essentially burned or cremated or whatever.
This interview is going to be cut. You can't edit this in a very dark, fatalistic way.
No, we won't.
Definitely not my my view right now.
I know. What would you choose?
I don't know. I think, I don't know. I haven't even settled that question for myself with my physical body. I think I see an incredible poetry to both. I see a poetry to becoming dust, and I also see a poetry to giving the people who love you a place, a physical place that they can come to and sit down on the grass and think through their memories. I think both of those rituals are very beautiful, and I'm not sure that one is better than the other. I think it's maybe something that will become clear to me as I get older.
There was another question I wanted to ask you, which is, you know, there's this growing body of neuroscience brain research suggesting that humans are literally hardwired to seek and to make stories. So that's what our brains do all day long. You know, we gather all kinds of sense data all the time, and our brains are constantly, continually building stories out of it. Mm-hmm. Do you think all of your computer interactive projects are doing something similar? Are you building something like a great big story-making brain in a cloud?
Well, I tend not to think about it as some kind of computer intelligence thing like that. I really see it as individual people with individual agency over their individual stories. And when you put enough of those together, you do start to get this kind of meta thing coming through. But I'm really not so much after the meta thing coming through. I'm really after giving people as individuals a rich experience. I think that when it comes to storytelling itself, it is something that's very deep in us. And I think the role that it plays has to do with organizing our experience so that we can make sense of it, so things don't seem so crazy. I know there's some really interesting research by a doctor called Dr. Jonathan Shea, and he studies soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress disorder. And he compares these soldiers to soldiers in ancient Greek tragedies coming back from war, like the Trojan War. And the main difference, he cites, is that in ancient Greece, the soldiers would have this decompression period on the journey home, on the boat, where they can sit with their other soldiers and process the horrors of war that they just experienced, make stories about them, and figure out a way that they're going to talk about that stuff to their loved ones when they get home. So stories become this device that insulates them from the trauma. Whereas nowadays, you have these soldiers overseas who get their leg blown off in Fallujah, and they're on the next flight home, and then the following evening they're sitting at a TGI Fridays in Peoria, Illinois, with their family having mozzarella sticks. And there's not that time to decompress and make stories out of the experience. And so you get this post-traumatic stress disorder. Basically, people freak out because they don't have the ability to make stories. So stories are a very useful device in making sense of what happens to us. And when you don't have that chance to make stories, bad things can happen to you, I think. So I think it's a very useful thing that we do as humans.
And not just stories, I think, because with your reference to sagas, I think you were, you know, kind of invoking myth. And I think that's when we can all tell a story about, you know, the thing that happened to me yesterday on the way to the supermarket and the funny person I met and blah, blah, blah. But some stories are better than others, just like we all have dreams, but every now and then you have a big dream. And So some of those stories, you must clearly be wanting to create a level of story that is more like myth than like anecdote.
Exactly, yeah. That's important to me. And the way I think that you do that at web scale is you have to get lots and lots of people telling stories, and then a few of them will be like these little sparkling gems. And a lot of them won't be so interesting, but that's actually okay, because even the most banal, badly photographed, poorly written story that you can imagine will still be very interesting to the people who love the person who wrote that story. And therefore, it's useful to allow those types of stories also to exist alongside the really great ones. And what you have to do as a system designer is you have to make sure that only the really great ones are the ones that most people bump into when they're looking around the site, but that even the less great ones are still there and they still have a home and they still have a purpose specifically for the people who care about the person that wrote those ones. So that's very much how I see it. Like I'm not trying to create an elitist ecosystem of excellent storytellers, although Calbert is really designed for great storytellers to use, but it's also designed for anybody to use. And the system will kind of sort them out so that as a viewer, you're exposed to the ones that are going to be interesting to you.
But I guess I was thinking about that word sagas that you use, and your earlier description was that there are events that are so big and involve so many people that they're challenging for the news media to cover. A war, yeah. For instance, or the Japanese tsunami, or the Occupy yeah. movement, for that matter. Maybe those are the mythic stories. You know, during Homer's time, it was the Trojan War, and he yep. made myth out of that. And maybe that's what a mythic story is, a story that is too big and involves too many people to compress into a single narrative.
I think that's right. And I think that the way that you communicate a saga or the way that you communicate a myth is, first of all, it's difficult to communicate the myth as such while it is happening. You can only really see the myth, I think, once you have hindsight, once you have some distance from the thing. But what you can do while it's happening is you can create a folk history of the thing as it's going on. You can collect the individual experiences of people touched by the thing. And those are like the living history. Those are the primary sources. And then with time, you can start to sort out the larger patterns and themes and mythologies. But those take some distance from the act, I think. And I think that one of the things that like the news media, for instance, is struggling with right now with these big global events, is they're kind of going for the 10,000-foot description while the thing is still happening. And that's very hard to do because no one even knows what the thing is or where it's going or what its true nature is. So I think all you can really do right now is chronicle the experiences that individual humans are having with the thing. And then with time, this kind of poetic truth will start to emerge, but only with time.